This is a work session of the House State Affairs Committee. Today is Wednesday, May 15th, 1991. Time is 7:40. We have Representatives Moyer, Baker, Miller, Grunberg, and Covina.
Let me emphasize, 7:40.
A work session, as we have not duly given a 24-hour notice for official meetings. Representative Grunberg, would you like to brief us on House Bill 273? And is this a bill that we plan on just talking about today?
Well, I'd like to do what we can on it today. Thank you very much, first of all, for holding a hearing on this. This is a bill to amend the statutes that grant major medical insurance coverage to retired members of the teachers, judicial elected public officers, and the public employees' retirement systems, to provide that members of 65 or over must make the mandatory payments or pay tax surcharge for Part B of federal Medicare coverage, and the bill provides that they'll be annually reimbursed for these charges. It's something that we put in at the request of retired public employees, and I'd like to invite Bob Manners to come and really explain the details of the bill. Rather than listening to me, I'm sure you'd rather hear that.
Well, I want to invite Bob Manners to come also.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Manners.
Oh,
excuse us for meeting.
No problem. I just finished.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Manners. I'm with the National Education Association. I believe you have a position statement in your packet from NE Alaska, and we do support this legislation. I would call your attention in particular to a summary of the issue by Merritt Olson, who is a member of our retired system.
Did he leave?
He had to come back last night.
I'll send him a letter and apologize.
Well, he understood. He clearly understood the problem that's kicking at this point in the time of the session. As you can see, the concern is the financial burden that retirees when they hit age 65 have in terms of continuing their health insurance coverages under the system. And we feel very strongly that some relief, financial relief, ought to be available to them. His figures, and I'm just going to use round numbers, indicate that the cost of the insurance coverage to the system for those under age 65 is approximately $280 or $290 a month. And when they reach age 65, the cost of the system drops to $70 or $80 a month, but the retirees themselves have to commence the payment of the Medicare B premium, which covers their physician's care services. And for many retirees, especially those who have been retired for a number of years, this is a substantial financial burden on a fixed income and is projected not to become less, but probably become more over the years. There's also a question which I think may exist, but we don't have real strong, firm information yet, and I think deserves some research in the context of whether or not this additional cost to a retiree actually represents a reduced benefit. And if so, may be inconsistent with our constitutional provision that the benefits for public employee retirees, teacher retirees, and so on will not be reduced. And it would be predicated on the concept that when they have to commence paying a premium, actually that is tantamount to a reduction in the benefit. And so that concept alone may be the impetus for somehow finding a resolution to this particular problem. I'll try and respond to questions, and hopefully we can somehow, between now and the end of next session, find a resolution to this particular issue. Thank you.
You know, by the way, Mr. Chairman, for bills that were previously scheduled under unfinished business, you know, just continuing along the 24-hour rule is no impediment. We can take action.
Even for noticing when a meeting is, when you're going to have a meeting?
I think so. I think that's true.
Because we noticed a meeting at 8:30 and when we couldn't meet yesterday, tried to move it up an hour, but technically, it doesn't matter. We'll wait till we make the motion, so.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Is there somebody here that did this fiscal note?
I just need some clarification. There.
I
Chairman, for the record, I'm Bob Stallnaker, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. I didn't do the fiscal note, but perhaps I could answer some of the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could proceed, I just have some questions here. We're estimating an increase of the state contribution of 1.43%.
That's correct.
Out of a payroll of $545 million.
That would be the state's payroll.
Okay. Well, you come up, using that formula, you came up with $7,800. 1% of $545 million is $5 million and some. So I'm not sure where you come up with your numbers.
Well, it's 9 point some percent, which is 0.00. It's not 1%. Well, excuse me. I need to
But that's not the way the thing is written.
Like I said, I didn't. That's $7,800,000. That's in thousands.
Okay, that's set. Well, okay, that's.
That's a point. That's in thousands. So that's 7,800,000.
Okay, that's.
Okay, I. So in other words, this fiscal note is not $28,000, but. $9,500,000.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, there are two components of the fiscal note. The fiscal note on the body identifies the cost to the division of implementing this, and it's estimated to cost the division $28,000 to make the necessary changes to the systems to accommodate this kind of change. The cost to the systems are identified down in the analysis and then broken out further on the back.
Okay, so in other words, the cost to the state, dollar-wise, is about $9.5 million, so that we have to contribute extra into PERS and PERS and all the other funds.
Yes, sir. And if I might clarify one thing, I think, and certainly I think Mr. Manners brings out an issue that might be looked at in looking at the Medicare Part B question in the past. It's been determined through the Attorney General's office that there's not a diminishment of benefits because the health insurance plan for retirees, since its inception in 1975, has always been secondary to Medicare for retirees age 65 and older. Now, that plan hasn't changed. The fact that the federal government may raise the Medicare B premiums or change the Medicare B premiums is something beyond the control of the system. But the system is currently rated. It was designed to provide health coverage to all retirees and to, in essence, hold them harmless when they had the option of getting the Medicare Part B at age 65. So if this bill is passed, there will be a dramatic impact on the cost of the health coverage for the system itself. And we don't believe that there is a diminishment of benefits issue here because the plan from its inception in 75 had always been secondary to Medicare.
When this started now, they didn't have to pay for it originally because there was. Did the state ever pay for it?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not. Well, the state had never paid for the Medicare Part B. No. The Medicare, now how long the retirees have had to pay for Medicare? It's my understanding that they've always had to pay for the Medicare Part B. We're checking that out at this point in time. But the state health plan had always been secondary to the Medicare for people age 65. It had never paid the first dollar for age 65 and older people.
You want to come up, Bob? Point of work session, can we just do a more formal here? You want to add to that? Give a different view?
I'd like to do a different view.
Okay.
I think that I can't quarrel with what Bob said. However, whether or not Medicare is the primary or secondary coverage, I think is immaterial. If there was a point in time that employees did not have to pay for the coverage. And secondly, in order to continue physicians' care services, which is an option at age 65, they must pay for it. And it could become for many already is, becoming a prohibitive cost. And that's our concern as much as the potential diminishment of benefit. But I think there is some reason to look at it from a potential diminishment of benefit question as well.
Can the state just pay the federal government rather than reimbursing the employee?
Mr. Chairman, it's our understanding that there would be one of two ways that we could do it. Either increase all retirees' benefits by the amount of the Medicare B premium, thereby allowing them to make the payments. We cannot pay Medicare. We can increase their benefits. That's additional taxable, but I mean, that's beside the point. They could then take that money and buy the Medicare B premium, or pay the Medicare B premium. Or we could change our health plan to cover first dollar, which would be much higher than this fiscal note estimates, because the Medicare does pick up, I think it's, I'm not even sure what the Medicare benefits are, but they do pick up first dollar, and then our plan will come through and make people whole up to what our plan covered prior to age 65. So I think those would be the only two options available to us.
I just
also noticed on the fiscal note that then also $9.5 million to the state, and then the political subdivisions around the state would be another $10.5 million.
Exactly. The state, of course, is one of 160 different employers, and anything that we do, certainly we have to show the impact of the state, but it also has an impact to the other political subdivisions.
Mr. Chairman. Then if I understand that correctly, and Bob, maybe you can help me. So if the 10, if the political subdivision cost is $10.5 million annually, and about 40% of those employees either work in the Anchorage School District or the municipality of Anchorage, I believe. So the cost to our municipality would be about $4 million. Is that a fair assessment?
I would say, through the chair, Representative Baker, if you had a ballpark number for the salaries for Anchorage, would probably be the easiest and take 1.5% roughly of that.
Which, just kind of carrying the theory down a little bit further, what vehicle you use, because that's a cost, and that goes into the cost structure, and suddenly you have to create a tax base to pay for that, or you have to increase the instructional unit to pay for that, but there has to be a course of, I mean, just like putting more water into the balloon. Somebody's got to pay for it.
Suppose it were optional at the local level.
Creating a different class of retirement.
I think, Mr. Chair, that would be my first response, is that certainly we've never been supportive of setting up a multiple-tiered system for different employers in the system. It would be a hard thing to try to administer, because then you'd have people write back the next day and say, my employer doesn't elect to do it, but we're the ones getting hurt by it, and I think we'd be hit by that.
How much does the retiree now pay for his Part B per month on it?
I believe the premium is $29 a month, something like that. $30 a month.
What's the department's position? I don't notice anything here. I see the fiscal note, but no. Position.
Due to the cost, Mr. Chairman, we'd be opposed to this.
Anything to add? Anybody? Okay.
What do you suggest? How can we do it without having such a high cost?
I really don't know.
You can see
Mr.
the
Chairman,
problem and give us a solution.
Certainly. I think the solution is probably as it's laid out. It's just one where there's a big bullet to have to bite to be able to say that we can or we cannot do it. I think what we're faced with, and certainly what we've projected in this fiscal note, is it's not going to stay at $30 a month. It's going to increase. As Social Security costs increase and health costs increase, Medicare Part B premium is going to increase and become more of a burden on retirees. We've had to assume that in the cost that we've displayed. Either they suffer the costs or the system suffers the costs. Perhaps a way is some combination between an increase in the contribution amount for the members and an increase by the amount the employer pays. Maybe a shared approach would lower the cost of the employers. This is a time when we're talking about increased benefits. Maybe that has to be the way we start looking at some of these things. But this is one of those very thorny things that says, okay, if the policy is that we feel that there is a liability here or there is a responsibility or a moral issue, there's a cost to it, and there's really not a lot of a way to get. I'd like to have another idea how to do it differently, but this is kind of...
Mr. Chairman, if I may. How do others see this?
I think what you find with other states is, first of all, some other states don't provide any health care. Or other states provide health care that the retiree pays 100% of the cost. States that do provide health care for the retirees, some states are like us, they have the retirees that pay it, and other states pick up the cost up to a certain amount. In other words, instead of maybe increasing it to $30 or $29, they may say, we'll increase retiree benefits by $15 to help cover the Medicare Part B payment, which is another alternative, perhaps. So I think you see it in a broad spectrum. There are certainly those states where the retirees are much worse off than our retirees, even if this bill had no action to it when it comes to health insurance. And there are states that, I'd say our plan is one of the most generous in the public plans with the health insurance that we do provide.
Manager?
I want to just observe, in terms of clarification, at least from our perspective, that this payment of this premium, if it were to be factored into the actuarial cost for employers, we don't perceive it as an increased benefit. We feel that the health care benefit is the coverage and the premium cost, and until you hit age 65, there is no premium cost. And this is an adverse financial impact, so we see it as a diminished benefit. Brought to the question of the employee sharing the cost, just last year the employee contribution rate went from 7 to 8.65, which is a substantial increase, and I don't think that active employees, are at a point where they could feel that they could share this particular burden. Relative to the specific question of, or more specifically toward Representative Green's first question in terms of options and alternatives, while it's not unique to this issue alone, I don't think there is an easy answer until we, from a public policy perspective, look at more things in terms of needs-based, whether it's a loan program or this kind of thing and so on. And so the ease of finding interim solutions or intermediate solutions is not there.
Mr. Manners just wanted to be a representative for a half hour from Jim Brooklyn, and we gave him that opportunity.
This hour, tell me to go for it.
Yeah. There's another chair right there, Bob. Well, you get up to go. Brooklyn, why?
Thanks, Karen. Bob, you may have mentioned it in the opening remarks, and I just apologize for repetition, but maybe you could talk a little bit about the federal action that took place this year.
The older
President Bush, older workers benefit protection. Did you already talk about that?
No, I didn't talk about it. It's referenced in our Merritt Olson's letter to you. I'm not totally familiar with it, but it's my understanding that it does require an equity perspective in terms of making benefits available to employees based upon age. I'm not sure that it has a full impact on this, but we're trying to discover right now whether or not the presence of that act might in fact cause it to have to become an administrative resolution of this issue right away. I'm uncomfortable being technical on it until I back and look through the notes on it.
I mean, so we're not sure if the federal act applied to just federal employers or if it applied to all employers in the country, or,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moore, the act which you're speaking, it's our interpretation that it does not impact this. We followed it through the Congress. It does apply to all ERISA plans. There's another issue, the public plans are not required to qualify under ERISA, but we do, all the same. I don't believe that act impacts this issue. There are other issues within the retirement systems that act may impact, and we're looking into at this point, but it's been the general understanding of public pension plans across the country that it does not impact the Medicare B issue.
What would be an example of another plan that may impact, would you say?
One would be a provision under the retirement system is that if you go on non-occupational disability, you are on non-occupational disability until you reach normal retirement age. If a person is already older than the normal retirement age when they become disabled, then under our plan they get appointed to retirement. That could be considered discriminatory under this act, in that they're not being afforded disability benefits, which happen to be the same benefit they would get if they were retired. And that's what we're looking into, is to exactly, since our plan does provide, in essence, the same dollar benefit that is available for disability for retiree. But that's an example.
When you come to your conclusions, would that result in new legislation from the governor's office or incorporation with some similar bill? Or can you do that administratively?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Moyer, if we were to determine that this issue is certainly tied in with that, we would be required, because of the federal law, to offer to the legislature amendments that would rectify all those types of things. Yes, sir.
Seems somewhat discriminatory to me that you're paying $267 for people under 65 and you're paying $76 for people over 65.
In reality, Mr. Chairman, we are, just as we do for the state of Alaska employees' health plan, we pay one premium. That one premium covers all retirees for the provisions of the health plan. Just as for the active employees, it covers all active employees, whether they're single, married, one child, two children, many dependents, no dependents, very ill, not ill at all, we pay one premium. And we don't break it down. Now, certainly actuarially, we have to recognize the cost difference because, yes, in fact, it does cost less for retirees age 65 and older. The vast majority of our retirees are under age 65. So that's where most of the cost is going anyway.
We can't take any motions yet. I would like to move the bill up to finance and maybe with a letter on it or something saying, you know, we see a real high cost to the state here, but I certainly see something, an issue. I'd like to see if there's a way to address that. I'm going to have some to work on it. Mm-hmm. What's the rest of the committee's thoughts?
That's my thought.
Would you want a motion to
No, we can't. We're on a work session, actually, until 8:30.
Oh.
I didn't get a 24-hour ruling. So we got the bills before us, but we're only on a work session. So we're informal. Anybody else?
I don't think that's going to be
anything else on this? Gerardo or anybody? Anything on that?
Oh, yes, that'll be true.
All right, thank you both of you.
Thank you. That will be your response. Thank you.
We have anybody? Parker, are you able to talk on the 42?
Barely, sir. But I.
It's Brandon.
Oh, here, see. She's able to talk on 42.
I just meant we'll bring it up. Again, we're under a work session, so we're not taking any action here at this time. The next bill I'd like to talk about, though, is House Bill 42 by Representative Ulmer, an act relating to benefits for state employees in permanent part-time positions.
What's
your name for the record, please?
Diane Lindbeck for Representative Ulmer. The broad purpose of House Bill 42 is to establish a public policy recognizing part-time employment as a valuable and desirable career choice for both the employer and the employee. And the bill does this by rectifying several inequities accruing to part-time employment in state service. The real motive for doing this is our recognition that over the next decade, women will enter the marketplace in increasing numbers, and that they will constitute the fastest growing sector of the labor force. Single parent families find it increasingly difficult, and those families in which both parents work, find it increasingly difficult to meet both their financial responsibilities to remain independent and their family responsibilities, whether it is for children or their aging parents. So we feel that in establishing a public policy in favor of part-time employment, it is in our benefit to society as a whole to create at least no disincentive for people to find part-time employment. So House Bill 42 rectifies the inequities which currently exist for in-state employment by the following. It requires part-time employees to pay half the premium for health insurance. Now, currently, if you are a part-time employee, you can either pay half the premium if you purchase health insurance that regular full-time state employees get, and the cost of that is $193. And if you're not making very much money, that tends to be too much, and so they choose a lesser policy, which in the past they have purchased through SBS. But they pay the entire premium for that lesser policy. That is only for themselves. It's only major medical. There's no visual, dental, or audio benefits. And that cost is $71. Now, what this bill does is to require state employees, part-time state employees, to pay no more than half the premium for health insurance. And so the state will have to offer a lower cost. We're asking them to prepare a lower cost health insurance for part-time employees. Secondly, it allows part-time employees to achieve permanent status after the same probationary period as full-time employees. The current practice is to compute your eligibility for permanent status on the basis of the number of hours worked. And if you're working half-time, it's easy to figure out that it's going to take you twice as many months or years to qualify for permanent status. Now, it's our contention here that management, if you are coming every day, and we're talking about part-time employees here only, we're not addressing this to seasonal employees, it's our contention that management has adequate time to determine whether that employee has fulfilled the responsibilities of that job, and they are able to determine whether they should receive permanent status after the same probationary period in terms of months as full-time employees. Thirdly, it allows permanent part-time employees to qualify for salary and leave accrual increases after the same period of time as full-time employees. Now again, salary and leave accrual increases are computed on the number of hours worked, not on the length of time, and this would change that so that after your first, your merit increases would fall on the same annual basis as full-time employees. And fourthly, it allows part-time employees to vest in the public employees retirement system after the same period of time as full-time employees. Currently, part-time employees become vested in the retirement system based on the proportion of time they are employed. An employee must work at least 15 hours per week to qualify for vesting as a part-time employee. For example, an employee working 15 hours per week will be vested in 10 years. An employee working 20 hours per week will become vested in 7.5 years. Requiring vesting to occur as a result of the total number of hours worked by a state employee penalizes those individuals who work part-time, either by choice or necessity, and serves as a disincentive to permanent part-time employment. So allowing permanent part-time employees to vest in PERS on the same basis as full-time employees will encourage part-time employment as a career choice. And if I could direct your attention briefly to this little chart which we have included. Looks like this, compares part-time to full-time employees. This compares over a five-year period a full-time with a part-time employee, or two part-time employees. And this is to demonstrate to you that there is no additional cost to the employer for making these changes in part-time employment. In year one, we're talking about a range of 17 employees considered a professional employee. Part-time, we have, for example, two employees working half-time. Year two, at the end of the first year, beginning of the second year, the full-time employee achieves permanent status and receives a 3.5% merit increase. But in year two, the part-time employees have had no change in status and no increase. Year three, the full-time employee receives another 3.5% merit increase for a total of 7%. In year three, the part-time employees have finally achieved permanent status and received their first 3.5% merit increase. In year four, the full-time employee receives another 3.5% merit increase. There is no change to the part-time employee's status or salary status. And in year five, the full-time employee receives another merit increase for a total of 14%. However, the part-time employees who have worked just as long, come in every day, demonstrated the same capability and loyalty to their employers, have received over that same period of time half of the salary increase that the full-time employee has. And we see this as a disincentive to those persons who may need, and increasingly in the future we will have employees who need to work part-time and spend part of their day caring for family members. And this bill will change this so that both part-time and full-time employees employees are treated equitably.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you just stated that there would be no increase in cost. I don't see how that's possible.
Well, from one perspective, you're absolutely right. The employer has a savings now if he is employing part-time employees. But if the choice here is between hiring, if you are talking about whether you're filling a position with one full-time or two part-time employees, there is going to be no difference between in cost to the employer in making that choice. Now, in looking at the cost savings that are possible here in hiring part-time employees, you would think that the state is now encouraged and motivated to hire part-time employees, but that doesn't happen to be the case. And I don't know that I can tell you exactly why. There are only 295 part-time, classified part-time positions in state service now. We're talking about a very small number of people. The state generally, as a whole, is not eager to hire part-time or job sharing. And for very good reasons, as you can see, there are employees who are not eager to take that up and go much more slowly on their track towards permanent status and salary increases.
This only deals with state employees, not subdivisions.
That is correct. Yes.
Just the other one is on the vesting in the retirement system. Now, if we were in, say, at least the way it used to work back in the mid-70s, and say in the Teamsters Union, you got your years on hours worked, just like, I think it was 2,000 hours you had to work in order to get 1 year's vest. You could work 4,000 hours and get 2 years vested in 1 year, but if you only worked 1,000 hours, you only got a half a year. I'm just having a little problem right now, just saying that you can work a half a year, but yet that counts as one full year in investing under PERS. I just have a little problem with that concept.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond, I agree that has been a problem that has occurred to a number of other people, and given our conventional way of looking at computing service and assuming that everyone will be or should be a full-time employee, your response to that is reasonable. When we step back and say, we are going to assume now that some people need to be part-time employees and we want them to be part-time employees, because if they're not, then their responsibilities to their family will be borne by the state in terms of child care or elder care. If we step back and say that we need to provide for a separate kind of career track, then we need to look at what happens to them as they prepare for their retirement. And if it's going to take them twice as long, they're making less money. We're not saying that the benefit they get in retirement is going to increase in any way. That is still based entirely on how much they work and their salaries. But if we're saying these people, this group of people, is going to be part-time employees for 20 years, but it's going to take them twice as long to even vest, it's going to be very difficult for them to make that a career choice that adequately prepares them for retirement. So we need to think about this in a different kind of a way, with different assumptions about the needs of the workforce.
Mr. Chairman, if this legislation passed, create different classes of people within PERS, because in the municipality of Anchorage and in the Anchorage school system, people are vested in PERS based upon the number of months or hours that they work. A perfect example is the school secretaries, where they work 9 months and they are vested accordingly. So, and they are in PERS. So if we adopted this as law for the state, and those classified employees that are in PERS here would be treated differently than classes of employees that are in PERS in the local political subdivision. And there might be some conflicts, because you have two classes of people in the same classification, but within the same program. I guess it can probably happen, but it just so that we're aware of the risk.
Are you suggesting that we not do this at all, or are you suggesting that we include political
subdivisions?
I'm just
putting it right square up on the table so that everyone understands.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I regret that I need to leave. We have a bill up in Senate Finance right now that I need to prepare for. And just in comment to Representative Baker, yes, we are aware that there may be some pressure in regard to this to change it so that it is applies equally to everyone, and that was certainly within our thoughts when we said this is a public policy. Right. We would like to encourage this.
Yes, just a quick question. I have a big experience for this. As an option, and if you're talking about a career path, could you not consider if someone stayed with the state for 5 years, and then at the end of 5 years, they could be vested, but if they left after 1 or 2 years, they don't get 1 or 2 years credit. They got credit for how much time they actually worked. But if you stick around for a certain amount of time, then you're obviously on a career track, if that's your concern, you could do it that way, just as a throw out another alternative. Mm-hmm.
Somewhat surprised at the secretarial comment by Representative Baker. I didn't
know. Thank you, Dan. Mr. Otto, would you like to raise your phone as well?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Otto. I'm the Director of the Division of Personnel. I certainly agree with the intent of this bill. We are very much involved in research as it relates to Workforce 2000 issues and the increase of minorities and women in the workplace. I've been working with Representative Ulmer over the last couple of years, frankly, in terms expanding or maybe educating the workforce as it relates to part-time employment. We have recently, just in our admin manual as well as in standard operating procedures, kind of gotten the word out about how to do job sharing and how to set up part-time positions and that kind of thing. I'm very much aware because of several people in my office have taken, we do job sharing quite extensively, in fact, in our office. Some of those people are actually doing it from the perspective of Representative Ulmer's bill, that is perhaps to go home and take care of children, but there are others that are doing it to go fishing in the afternoon or to run a private business in the morning or to do a variety of other things. I think it really comes down to a matter of personal choice. And frankly, I think that this bill would tend to have more of a negative impact on part-time employment instead of positive. Let me run through it real quickly. On the probationary period, if I only have half the amount of time to evaluate a probationary employee, they bring up the point that obviously the person comes to work every day for 4 hours a day. She also used the example of range 17. In most range 17s, those people are not overtime eligible, and therefore actually we expect 50 or 60 hours of productivity a week out of that employee. And they come in early and stay late.
Could you explain that a little bit? So,
I'm talking about
range 17s aren't eligible for visitors.
Not in all cases, but in a lot of cases,
so
these people are not.
You expect them to work instead of a 38 or a 40-hour week. You expect them to work.
I expect them to give their lives to us.
60-hour week. But once you get up into the overtime, big-time bucks, why you only get to work 38 hours, and after that, we're going to pay double time. Well, you're giving a good argument for not only this, but for quite a few other changes, I would say.
No, I think you misunderstood, though.
No, I misunderstood.
What I'm trying to simply say is that we get a great productivity out of part-time employees as well as full-time employees. But when you use an example of the higher ranges, we do expect our higher-level professional people who are exempted from Fair Labor Standards Act to put in quality work and to produce the product, whatever that means. And sometimes that means asking staff to stay late or to come in extra early in order to accomplish the task. The point of it is that if I have a person who's coming in for 4 hours a day or 3.5 hours a day, I have half the amount of time. If the probationary period is 6 months or the probationary period is 1 year, a full-time person must go through that entire period of time, and I have morning and afternoon to evaluate that person. I now have half the amount of time. The ability for me to potentially place a person in permanent status too early could have a negative impact. Eligibility for leave is one of the things here as well that I think will have a fiscal cost. In fact, we're in the process right now preparing a fiscal note as well as a bill analysis, and I apologize to you that that's not on the table in front of you at this point. But in half the amount of time, the person will be able to, like in 2 years, you can go to the next step as far as higher leave accrual, and this will happen. We just don't think it's fair for full-time employees that a part-time person can be there half the amount of time. I think it's a question like investment. I mean, I can argue with the person who's got $50,000 in the bank, why did they get $5,000 of interest a year? And I only get $10 of interest a year, irrespective of the fact that I only put $100 in the bank in the last 10 years and somebody else put thousands in. I mean, it's a question of how much you place, so to speak, into the investment in terms of your work as to what you get out of that. The other is just simply there will be a salary or merit increase earlier for a part-time person than for a full-time person. They put in half the amount of time and still get a merit increase. We don't think that, again, is equitable. We think the system as it currently is equitable as it's put together. I think that the reason why there's so few that actually are using the system, frankly, has been the lack of education, and that's what we've been trying to do, is to try to educate the workforce and management regarding the value of having job sharing and part-time employment. But fundamentally, those come down to not issues of cost to the person, but rather issues of choices. And so the administration at this point is opposed to this, and because I frankly personally believe that it'll tend to have more of a negative impact on part-time employment for the manager, and they'll not encourage it, then it would be to leave it alone.
Comments from the committee? Well, I think that it would be quite the incentive for the employer to promote job sharing when, under the current system, as you noted, they can save money. If they split the position in half, they still get it filled for a time. But...
Through the chair, Mr. Moyer, there is some truth to that, but the flip side of it is that I've also got twice the amount of training to deal with productivity questions and issues. I give somebody a major project, I'm going to have to split that somehow, some way. It depends on the nature of the job, frankly. And for most people, obviously, we'd rather have a full-time person doing a job to a large extent. But the flip side of it is, I think we've done very successfully, at least I know within our division, we have half a dozen people that are involved in some form of job sharing or part-time employment. And again, those have been usually at the request of the employee, and that we've gone to split that, whether someone was having a child or there was a crisis in the family, whether there was a private business or something else that they wanted to do, or go fishing. And I think for the most part, we have a personnel system that's relatively flexible to meet the needs of the workforce, whether it's full-time or part-time or anything in between. But it's all on a pro-rata kind of basis. The argument could simply be made, too, that why can't people work 4 hours a day and get paid the same that a person who works 8 hours a day?
That'd be silly.
Sure.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak for?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, I'm Bob Stolnaker, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement Benefits. For the retirement system to attract part-time employees, I don't think, certainly by Mr. Otto's testimony, that that's the case. I think if it was the concern of the other public employers under the PERS system, you would have been receiving calls from them to want to be included under this, if they needed this to use as an incentive to attract part-time employees. I would agree with Mr. Otto, this would probably serve to be a less of a, or more of a disincentive to hire part-time employees because the cost would be going up. What we have in the retirement systems, one issue that's an equity issue. We have employees that are giving full days for 5 years to become vested. This bill would allow employees to give half days for 5 years to become vested, and not even all members of the system. You could have an employee that worked 2.5 years as a part-time employee for the state and 2.5 years as a part-time employee for the city of Anchorage or the municipality of Juneau and would not be vested when the person that lives right next door to him worked 5 years for the state as a part-time employee and is vested. It would create a situation that would be very hard to try to deal with if it was allowed to only affect state employees. I think that is one issue that should be addressed in this bill. Either you make it consistent across the system, or you don't consider that for state employees. Or you'd have the municipality of Anchorage in here next year asking for the same kind of treatment by virtue of their employees, not necessarily the municipality. So I think we have an equity issue. One in that that you're not treating part-time employees the same as full-time. I think they're being treated the same way now. As was pointed out by Representative Miller, they have to work 2,000 hours to get a year of vesting. Now they have to work 2,000 hours to get a year of vesting, in essence, or a full 12 months of service to get a year of vesting. This would allow them to be vested in half the term. And that would then be unequitable or inequitable to the full-time employee. And then the other issue is it only affects state employees when it leaves everybody else out of the woods. So I guess I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
If you're a part-time employee for 15 years under this bill, after 15 years, you have 15 years in the system, and then you went on full-time for, well, let's say, it's a 30-year retirement for PERS. So let's say you're a part-time employee for 25 years. You'd be have 20, under this bill, you'd have 25 years retirement purposes, correct?
No, Mr. Chairman, the provision deals only with the five-year vesting requirement. And it would still mean that a person, in essence, if they work part-time their whole career, would have to put in 60 years of part-time service. What we generally find with part-time employees is they will, for the most, work 1 or 2 years before they can find a full-time job. Most people are guided to try to get full-time jobs. People that want to make a career part-time, generally an economic decision. They can afford to work part-time because they only want a little bit of money to help in their family income. They want to get out of the house. They want to run a business on the side. They want to take care of their children for any number of different reasons. But this only affects the best.
I just see a discrepancy in, for example, the school systems, where a teacher works, quote, 9 months, and that's a year of service. The classified people in the school system work 9 months, and that's 9 months in the system. So they, while a teacher has 20 years, they do it in 9 months, 20 years in 9 months. A classified employee has to do 30 years, and so really they probably got to do 40 years of 9 months. Yeah, but obviously it's a different issue. Let me tell you what I think on this bill, so you guys have an idea what I'm thinking.
What do you think on the bill?
I think I'd like to have Representative Ulmer here talk with us. I think we'll keep this bill and have her come back or first, second
sometime
week next
year
and talk about it some more. And yes, oh, I have three hands.
Oh,
so let me.
I'll be quick.
Representative Grunberg, the record should note it's full of humor this morning.
And now we're
happy to
see
it.
This is
no, I have to.
Oh,
we have to quit this and come back.
Okay. Real quick, it seemed to me that a lot of part-time employees taking part-time positions because they don't qualify for full-time. In other words, their resume, their job experience isn't as complete. Perhaps their education isn't as high. That's a way to accumulate experience and eventually get a part-time job. Okay.
Well, just to throw this out, for better or for worse, we do it already in the legislature. If you came on after 1986 and worked more than 80 days in a session, at the end of 5 years, you're vested, even though you worked five sessions, not 5 years. Of course, if you don't work for five, as I said before, you don't get credit for 4 years. You get credit for 4 sessions or however many days that is. And,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moyer, we didn't like that idea either. However, if I might add, working for the legislature is only for the state. It doesn't impact other employers. So that issue did not involve that. And it was the decision of the legislature that seemed to be a way to attract people to work for the legislature because it was a defined period of time. I don't think that's true with part-time employment in general with the state or any other employer. So there are some apparent similarities, but there are some very strong dissimilarities too with that issue.
I think it's a valid point if you're talking about a career part-time person versus, like you say, someone who's got a year or two and you never see them again. That's where I try to make a distinction.
That's
John
Greenberg. Yeah, just this is a. There are lots of wrinkles in this. I'm in a job sharing situation with my law firm. My partner covers for me when I'm here in the session, and she takes off in the summer because her husband's a teacher, and I cover for her. And I know they do that a lot now. It seems to me that this is a way to attract qualified people to public service who otherwise wouldn't be able to work. For example, people who have the children or other kinds of commitments. and it may provide the supervisors with additional options that they wouldn't otherwise have, because good people can go to the private sector and have more flexibility sometimes, particularly if they're doing their own business or something like this. It may be a way actually to attract some good people and thereby increase productivity. You know, you were talking about increasing productivity, at least at certain levels, which was disputed by certain people and then denied by you, but at least it was a desire to attract good people and increase the productivity. And that's kind of hard to quantify, but I think it's nevertheless a benefit.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bloomberg, I don't disagree that this would serve to help attract. I think any time you make a benefit more generous, it helps to attract. The issue that I was bringing up is there's been no need expressed by the state that they need any help attracting part-time employees. And certainly as evidenced by your not being contacted by other employers in the public employee system, there certainly doesn't seem to be a need for the other employers, other 160 employers in the system, that they need help attracting part-time employees. So I'm not disputing that this would help to attract. I'm saying that no employer feels the need to have any more help attracting part-time employees. They seem to be getting the part-time employees they feel they need at this point in time. And since the purpose of these systems are to be used as a tool to help an employer meet their employment or their hiring needs, then the point I was trying to make is the employers do not feel they need this at this point in time to help them attract more people.
If I may just have one more question. We generally talk about, in the budget, filling positions. Might it not be to some advantage to allow, to encourage the use of half-time positions or part-time positions, so that the question wouldn't become only should we cut position A, but the options could be should we make position A a part-time position, or should we, instead of having position A, have positions B and C as two part-time positions? That would maybe make it somewhat easier for departments to survive budget cuts and to tone down the level of public employment without maybe being more humane in one way, maybe being more Machiavellian in another, that they could convince the legislature to fund the position part-time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bloomberg, I really can't get into discussions on the strategies in the budget process, or I wouldn't want to. I think what would happen is if you took a normal full-time position and you, through the budget, made it a part-time position, that person would either stay earning less or would seek another full-time position, and you'd have to hire a part-time person. And certainly those are all strategies that I think could be used. But I just think at this point in time there has not appeared to be the need from the employer's perspective to ask for additional assistance in trying to attract part-time employees.
Maybe they're just not aware of the option.
Perhaps in
a Mr. Chairman, I know that you want to get on to the regular meeting, but just to kind of wrap up, I guess I need a lot of convincing on this. I think we make economic decisions every day of our lives, and I think this is an employee has an economic decision whether they want to come on part-time or not. They know what the service is up front, and for many of the reasons stated, they may only want a part-time job to take care of children or own a business, but that's an economic decision that employee is making. And I guess you really have some problems here when you invest a part-time at the same time that it takes a full-time to vest. I think that creates some inequities too. So a word to the sponsor, I guess I'm just going to really need some major convincing on this piece of legislation. I just don't think it's needed at this point.
I guess we shouldn't have Charles in that conversation.
All right. Thank you. I'd like to close the work session. I'd like to remind anyone in the audience, if you want to testify on one of the bills, please make sure you sign up on the sign-up sheet or we will not recognize you.